The Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival begins today in Madison, and today we're taking a look behind the scenes. We're going to meet some filmmakers. I'm Anne Strainchamps. In this hour, we'll be talking with some remarkable young filmmakers from the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe. They're just 14 years old and premiering a short documentary called Protect Our Future. It explores the effect a planned open-pit taconite mine will have on the people and the ancient rice beds of the Bad River watershed. But first, filmmaker Alex Rivera is back in Wisconsin this fall as the UW-Madison Artist in Residence. For the past 15 years, Alex has been using film to tell stories about immigration, technology, and the globalization of information. His first feature film, Sleep Dealer, is a science fiction feature set on the U.S.-Mexico border in a dystopian world of virtual immigration and human drones. It won multiple awards at Sundance and other film festivals. And he's also just released a music video he made with Aloe Black and the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. The song, Wake Me Up, is number one on the charts in a whole lot of countries. And also Variety magazine recently listed Alex as one of 10 directors to watch. So, Alex, welcome to the studio.
Hey, thanks. Good morning. It's good to be here.
So that music video is just out, so I was thinking we could start there. Tell us about it. How did it come about?
Sure. Well, like you mentioned, for about 15 years, I've been making films and websites and other types of digital media, but all focused around the question of immigration and looking at the U.S.-Mexico border, the kind of immigration debate in this country, and the experience of living in this country in a family that is, in my case, partly immigrant, and trying to understand that experience and understand this crisis, which never seems to resolve itself, right? And part of that work has been meeting activists who are working at the grassroots level. And one of the organizations that I met along the way was the National Day Labor Organizing Network, which is a group based in Los Angeles that represents about 30,000 day laborers all around the country. Day laborers being the folks that, you know, you typically might see standing in front of a Home Depot or on the corner. So they're the most precarious kind of workers, the people who are most recently arrived and kind of seeking that very, very basic work and in a state of real need, you know. And so this organization works with those folks and does safety, advocacy, all kinds of work with that community. But part of what they do is cultural work, trying to raise the profile of that community, trying to explain the humanity of that community and the history of that community.
And give us a sense of who these people are, rather than just faces you see on a street corner.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And so they've worked with a bunch of artists, Zach De La Rocha from Rage Against the Machine, Manu Chao, and I've been doing a series of music videos with them, with those artists. And so I did one with, like I mentioned, Manu Chao, one with Ana Tiju, an artist from Chile, La Santa Cecilia, but most recently did this video with Aloe Black.
And what these videos are really, they're tiny, tiny little stories, little tiny, tiny narrative films. So in this one, it starts with, I'm trying to remember how it begins, actually.
Well, it begins with a young woman opening her eyes. It's so close. The first shot is a very, very, very tight shot on her eye. A single eye, and you see it open. You don't know if she's in bed or where she might be, and the camera pulls back, and it's revealed that she's in a swarming crowd in a protest and standing face to face with this police officer, and there's this kind of standoff, and we don't know what's going to happen, and then we cut and we go back in time, and we see her story evolve from her as a young child, and then we follow her basically through 20 years of growing up, crossing the border.
Getting detained at the border,
and then becoming ultimately crossing the border with her mother, becoming a young woman in America, and participating in the movement for justice and dignity for immigrants in this country. And so it's a music video that in 4 minutes spans 20 years of life, and it's all acted out by people who lived the story.
It's beautiful, and the song Wake Me Up by Aloe Black. It's a gorgeous song. Anyway, so that's up online if people want to see it. Now, as you said, immigration and borderlands are subjects you've returned to a lot in your work. Are there particular kinds of immigration or border stories that you've wanted to tell? I mean, how as a filmmaker and storyteller, do you avoid telling the same stories we've heard before?
Yeah, and well, I guess the first thing I would say is to conceive of the borderlands in a way that includes all of us. And so here we are, we're in Wisconsin, and I would say this, we are in a borderland. Obviously, we're close, relatively close to Canada, so in a literal sense, we're close to a border, even though when people say the border, they never mean Canada, they always mean Mexico, right? But obviously, Wisconsin is, in a sense, a border state. It's close to another nation. But in a different sense, it's even, you know, every state in this nation now is part of the U.S.-Mexico border industry, the border complex. Right now,
what
the
border. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that, you know, the history of the U.S.-Mexico border is rather fascinating. And in very, very brief, you know, for the first 80 years of the border between the U.S. and Mexico in its current form after the U.S.-Mexico War, which ended in 1848, for the following 30 years, 80 years, there was no enforcement. So there was nothing there. It was a line on a map, but not a line in reality.
And was there a lot of crossing back and forth?
There was constant crossing back and forth. And as a matter of fact, the federal government here in the U.S. didn't even consider people from Latin America to be immigrants. As the debates around immigration started to unfold in this country, people from Latin America and Mexico were not even considered to be immigrants. It was just a part of this place, a part of this flow. So
this is a period of time, though, when there were a lot of immigrants coming from Europe, and there were immigration debates about them. There were debates about how many Irish should we let in or how many Italians.
Mm-hmm. The first piece of immigration legislation passed in this country at the federal level is the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? So that's the first piece of legislation kind of targeting the movement of any population. But then as that legislation becomes problematic and other things change, the federal government starts to address immigration. But as you're saying, it starts with a system of quotas, and those quotas are all targeted at different European countries, and then other countries are just straight out banned. And so, like China, and then ultimately they expand it to other parts of Asia, is banned. But there's a set of immigration quotas that are ultimately put in place that target and try to control different European population flows. Mm. But what's interesting is for all that time period, Mexico, Latin America is just not even on the map. It's just assumed that basic people are going to come and go. It's just assumed. And so up until the 30s, there's really no enforcement on the southern border. And in the 30s, during Prohibition, there starts this whole a new rhetoric of calling, referring to Mexicans as a type of contraband, a type of, they call them, the first language used was bootleg. They would call them bootleg aliens. This is during Prohibition. And so the Border Patrol is created in the 1930s. And slowly over, now we're talking about the past 70, 80 years, the border starts to expand. And so the, and what I mean by that is that the Border Patrol at first is pretty tightly constrained to just patrolling the border. Like they're supposed to be kind of close to the line and patrol the border. Slowly, they are given license to go more further into the interior of the United States. In the 1950s, the Border Patrol is given license to go 100 miles into the U.S.
And what is it right now?
Well, it's still, in terms of the actual physical patrol of the border, the Border Patrol is given license to go 100 miles into the country. But what's interesting, it's inside any land border and any coastline. And so if you draw a 100-mile-wide ribbon around the perimeter of the United States, you cover cities like Chicago, New York, Atlanta, Miami, Houston. You cover ultimately 2/3 of the population of the country essentially lives in a border enforcement zone, we would count.
So this is why you'd say Wisconsin is actually in a border enforcement zone, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't think of ourselves that way. Well, we should talk about your film Sleep Dealer, which won a bunch of awards and was screened in Madison not too long ago. And it's set in a borderland, but in the future, on the U.S.-Mexico border. And it's kind of weird dystopian vision you've had where we're past the age of physical immigration and into an age of virtual immigration. Do you want to explain?
Sure. I guess it ties into the rant I was just on about the history of the border. It's just the idea that the border is not a fixed thing. You know, a lot of the times the debate, people say, what part of illegal don't you understand? As if it was a simple question. And my point of view is that the border is never simple, and it's a constantly evolving kind of matrix. And so, as I'm mentioning, it started to exist and be enforced in the 1930s. It has a very, very different form today. Highly technological heat sensors, infrared drones, All kinds of new technologies of surveillance have been experimented and developed on the U.S.-Mexico border. And that process isn't over. The change never stops. And so Sleep Dealer is a film. It's a feature film that takes a look, let's say, it could be 5 years, it could be 5 minutes, it could be 15 years into the future. It's an undetermined future. And in that future, the border is sealed completely. So it's a kind of right-wing fantasy of the border as a kind of Great Wall of China, Berlin Wall, ultimately fortified. However, in this future, other things have happened. And so the digital space that we all interact with on a daily basis has also changed and grown and allows in this future workers in places like Mexico, but let's say in countries all around the world, to connect their bodies to a kind of futuristic internet and control machines, we could call them robots, that do their labor in the United States. And so their pure labor travels across that fortified border through the digital net, and while their bodies stay out. And so there's
So there are these creepy scenes, for instance, where it's just there's a factory with a long row of people who look as though they're asleep, and they're all literally plugged in their arms to computers, and they're sort of waving their arms around, and then way somewhere else in the US or whatever, there's a robot who they're directing, who may be building a bridge or taking care of children or whatever. And is this because you think that that's the, sort of the ultimate fantasy of really what people in the developed world want? They just want the labor without having to deal with the human beings?
I think it, I don't know if it's what people want, but somehow it's what the logic of our economy tends to always point to, is that, in this country, one way or another, there's always a class of people often doing the most essential work, like, as you mentioned, taking care of kids or building things, picking food. Mm-hmm. Actually, the most essential activities to human life are often done in this country by folks that somehow are shut out of really being here. So whether it's we're talking like going back to histories of slavery or today with 11 or 12 million undocumented people who are here doing that type of work, but that are kind of also not here, shut out and not part of the political body of the nation. And so that sense of being here but not being here, and again, it's a phenomena and an experience I see in my own family of people who are very here, have been here for years and decades in some cases, but who are on paper not here.
Wait, what do you mean about seeing that in your own family?
Oh, I mean, I have cousins that are undocumented, who came from Peru in my case, who never were able to get their citizenship papers in order and either confronted returning to a country where they know there's very, very little economic hope and where they don't have roots at a certain point, and or staying here and living in a legal limbo. In a legal limbo, exactly. And so it's that sense of being here and also not being here that prompted a lot of these explorations that took me actually pretty quickly into science fiction, because that state feels or sounds like virtual reality.
And it sounds like what we've created with the internet, right? We all spend increasing amounts of our day in a virtual place where we are there and yet not there. So how strange that these two things should be happening together. So we'll talk more about that. We're going to take a very quick break. We're talking with Alex Rivera. He's an award-winning filmmaker, the director of Sleep Dealer, which is a futuristic science fiction film about immigration. He also directed a new music video for the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, featuring Allo Black singing the chart-topping hit Wake Me Up. Alex is in Wisconsin this fall as artist in residence at the UW-Madison, and you can join the conversation if you have thoughts about how immigration and information technology are linked. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can always chime in on our Facebook page, which is 45 North on WPR. We'll be right back. Coming up at 9 tonight, it's the Moth Radio Hour. This week, a family reunites around a hospital bed, a grandmother shares wisdom and a beer with her grandson, and a third grade teacher underestimates the power of Legos. Right now, we're talking with Alex Rivera, the award-winning filmmaker and director of Sleep Dealer. And Alex, we were talking, I wanted to ask you about the strange irony, coincidence, not coincidence, of the fact that we're having these increasingly intractable immigration debates at the same time that we're seeing the opening up of the global economy and the global virtual world on the internet. What's the relationship between those things?
Well, it's a that's the kind of core question that I've been exploring, and one of the things that I've been trying to do with my work is to put immigration in the context of a whole bunch of other globalizations, right? That we're living in a moment of great transformation in many different parts of our life and our society. And so an example would be to, you know, if you're there at home by yourself, take off your shirt and read the label, right? Where's your shirt come from? If you're driving, don't do this. But if you can, take a look, or take a look at the device that you're listening to this sound on. Where did that come from? So we all know that, right? It's not natural. It's actually very unique to this moment in time that everything we touch comes from a kind of global system. And then we look at the information that we're consuming, this kind of borderless space of our social networks, of the internet and those digital spaces. And so immigration now is happening and exploding at the same time that all of those other changes have happened. And it, to me, that can't be coincidence, right? That families, basically immigration is when a family becomes transnational, right? When a family becomes global, or when a family globalizes itself. So that families are globalizing themselves at the same time as trade is globalizing itself, at the same time that immigration is shooting all over the place across borders. That can't be a coincidence. But what's interesting is that all parts of that process are viewed as normal in our society. It's globalization, the free market, you can't stop it, except the movement of the family. Hmm. Right? So when the worker moves, that somehow they're called illegal, criminals, they're a specter, a kind of a terrible thing, right? However, every other type of movement is viewed as natural, normal, and fully welcomed.
That makes me think that, you know, every movement or every change we make has a shadow side, right? A side where we project our secret fears about what's happening. And so I'm thinking, when you're painting a picture of massive globalization, both physical and also information, and then the way we're kind of playing out, it's almost as though we need a fall guy, or a scapegoat, a place to dump our fears about immigration. So in this case, it's recent immigrants. But I'm also then wondering about the current, you know, debates we're seeing about information, the National Security Agency, security of information. I mean, that's also a just sort of unrelenting debate that's happening right now. And maybe that's another place that we're seeing this play out.
Yeah. I mean, I think these ideas that things have kind of spun out of control, right, that the globalization has distorted the economic globalization has kind of distorted the economy. Where'd the jobs go? Are they going to come back? First, the factories move overseas, and now they're coming back, but staffed by robots. What's happening? You know, what's happening there? And then this sense, of course, like you're mentioning in the informational space that the information that we want to share, but not share that much. We want to share it with all of our friends.
Or if we're sharing it, exactly who can see it.
Yeah, right. But somehow we enter into these bargains of we're willing to share the information in these kind of boundless spaces, but then also horrified that the government is using it or taking it.
And then you get governments really trying to control. Governments trying to control the border, and governments trying hard to control information.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a kind of core thing that I'm trying to explore in my films, is this impulse, like, how is it that certain flows across borders are normal, natural, welcome, and if you're against it, you're a protectionist, right? Like, I still see it on the news. If you talk about, like, well, we need to do something to keep jobs in America or do this, people say, oh, you're a protectionist. And then you flip the channel, and then you'll see border wars on National Geographic, and they're talking about, we got to protect the border. And protecting the border is that's a very, very mainstream phrase and a mainstream piece of the political discourse. But being anti-protectionist in the sense of, like, creating a border for trade, creating a border to control the flows of capital, that's outsider. And how is it that we got that kind of, where protecting the border is normal, but being protectionist and wanting to constrain the flows of capital, that's way crazy talk.
Like, so you're sort of suggesting that we really need to have a new concept of the borderlands as mental borderlands.
I think there, to me, the border has become synonymous with control and control of a specific entity, which is the human body, and a specific type of human body, which is the worker, right? If you're a tourist, you can cross that border. If you're an executive, you can cross that border. So it's not even targeting people, it's targeting working people. Mm-hmm. And what I would advocate for is a type of border that we could flip it around and say maybe this border could be a place of contact, exchange, of free movement for all kinds of people, and then also a place to kind of perhaps control corporations or control flows of capital so that there's less disturbances in our communities, like nearby, relatively nearby in Detroit, right? That is such a textbook case of the kind of havoc that can be wrought when capital flows very freely. So what if we had borders that tried to control that process, maybe slow it down or make it a little more human friendly, and that those borders were a place of more freedom of movement for everyday folks? And there's no reason it couldn't be that way. It's just, and it was that way for a long time in this country. So there's not a reason it couldn't be that way again.
I want to remind folks again, if you'd like to join the conversation, the lines are open for you, 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts about borders and borderlands, 800-642-1234. Or if you are a shy person, you can always email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. Alex, we should talk a little bit about your own personal background growing up. Now, you mentioned that you yourself are your father. You have two parents, mother from the course.
Got that right? That's correct.
Yeah, how exactly. Unusual. Mother born here in the U.S., but your father immigrated here from Peru. Is
That's
that right?
Right. That's yeah. Right. Yep. Yep. Yeah. No, two parents. Last time I checked, and both of them human. Which is something I'm also proud of, and but my mom is Irish American, born in Brooklyn, and my dad is Peruvian from Lima, and was the first in his family to come to this country. He came in the late 50s, age of 22, and worked in factories, was drafted into the army, and eventually met my mom in New York and did whatever people do to create a child.
And what was in your family? I'm thinking that those were interesting years for you and your when you were a child to have a dad who came from Peru, because there was an enormous amount of political turmoil going on in Peru. Then so how did that affect your dad or your sense of what it meant to have that connection to Peru?
Yeah. So I was raised in upstate New York in the 80s, and that was a really interesting experience because my mom worked at IBM. That's why we were in upstate New York. And my pop, of course, was connected to his still very connected to his family that he'd left behind in Peru, his mother, my grandmother, aunts and uncles. During the 80s, like you mentioned, it was a time of the Sendero Luminoso,
the Shining Path guerrillas
in Peru, and a real, a very, very intense civil war, real fear for life and limb. And so I would get that. Excuse me. I'd get those kinds of messages over the telephone from my extended family, but then I'd that night go to the mall in upstate New York, you know. And so it was a kind of
weird disjunction,
kind of schizophrenia, and from an early age, a sense of like, wow, this world that I'm living in here in upstate New York, rolling hills, the shopping mall, my high school, the world's much bigger than that.
And for you, a sense of again. It was technology that was mediating that, right? So your connection to Peru existed entirely on the telephone.
That's right. And back then it was very expensive, so just a few minutes here and there on the telephone. And then the television, of course, was my dad's kind of umbilical cord or lifeline to get information. But you're exactly right. My first film was a kind of reflection on that, the fact that it was a technology that kind of allowed my dad to virtually return home.
Because he was watching Spanish language television?
Yeah, watching Spanish language TV very intensely. And I speak to a lot of other children of immigrants. And I mean, who knows? Everyone's family is different. And I know lots of folks watch a lot of TV. But I think in immigrant families where the TV is this kind of lifeline to this other world.
Yeah, it's like your past world exists virtually on this screen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Yeah,
I want to take a call. We've got Todd on the line from Eau Claire. Hey, Todd, how are you?
Hey, greetings. in just in line with what you're saying, I think immigration has always been a search for identity, and we've used whatever technology that we've had to try to find that, whether it be shipping and now kind of relying upon higher tech communications. My question to the guest today, and from a realistic and from a science fiction standpoint, what is the possibility of someday some people getting together and declaring a physical-less nation based truly upon technology? I mean, the virtual
virtual nation.
And
I think Wikipedia
what
is.
Do you think that would have, and you know, kind of the how would that play, and from maybe from a science fiction standpoint, but yet also the possibility of, you know, people in a place but not in a place, but declaring allegiance to something virtual as that becomes more of a reality. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great question.
I love the thought, and it's something I've thought about off and on. I had this idea once for Wikitopia, a kind of idea of that democracy and the nation is ultimately a technology, right? Like democracy as we administer it is a technology. So voting is a technology. These machines, whether they're digital or you pull a handle or whatever it is, but voting is a kind of technology, and it seems like kind of an outdated one in many ways in terms of that you elect somebody and we do it in groups of thousands of people who are then supposed to represent us and express our will in these committees. And with the digital space, maybe there's other ways to express ourselves and to negotiate and to create policy that could be perhaps more direct or more constantly interactive. I don't know. It's such a mess the way it is. I don't know if we want more people getting involved. But I think that might be the answer. There is a kind of a way in which technology would allow us to reformulate democracy in a more interactive way.
Slightly a little scary because, I mean, I'm thinking, well, there already are kind of almost nations or worlds that exist online. Isn't that what World of Warcraft is? You know, you sort of go then and you work in guilds, and there are, I actually don't play World of Warcraft, so I don't know what the government structure is, but there probably is one. And then isn't that what the whole kind of Bitcoin debate is about, this idea that somebody created a form of currency that exists virtually and now wants to take it out and see if it can exist in the real world as well. So we're trying to mediate that, you know, or where is the dividing line between our physical world and our virtual world? Do you think we're just going to become virtual?
I would like that. Many mornings I would
really
like that. Instead of, I feel a little, I'm a bit tired and busted up. I wouldn't mind being here virtually this morning, but who knows where we're headed. But I do think the idea of like the nation as a kind of social compact amongst people that agree to kind of participate in some kind of a project that could be transformed by the digital, and a kind of, as the caller suggests, the creation of a kind of post-geographic nation. I think that's an interesting idea. I'm thinking of like Neal Stephenson. He explores these kinds of spaces and communities in books like Snow Crash.
Something you'd make a film about?
I think it would be fascinating because, you know, most science fiction films tend to be dystopia about things going kind of like horribly wrong, and then usually the fight to change it. There's very, very few films about anything going right. And I think it would be kind of fascinating to explore this idea of the digital creating the possibility of a different type of social organization. Where the drama would be, I don't know. But I think the caller is suggesting, and I think plugging into a truth, which is what is a nation in an age when jobs are flying all over the planet, products are flying all over the planet, people are crossing borders constantly. What is a nation? It starts to look like a kind of outdated piece of software.
You know, you mentioned dystopian films, and I am struck by, if you look on television, movies, increasingly, I mean, the dystopian film is really having its more than its day. It's been a couple of years now. You know, Walking Dead is one of the most popular shows on TV right now. What do you think all of this says about our culture? Is it that we're that pessimistic about the future, or is there... Sometimes I wonder if these are also escape fantasies where we're imagining the world as we know it gone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that right now the disaster film, the apocalypse film in Hollywood is having something of a heyday, and it's but it I don't know if I'm the only one, but those films are resonating differently to me now. In the world post-Katrina, in the world post-Sandy, in the world post-9/11, the Hollywood disaster film where they, with glee, destroy New York City, or with glee, destroy Los Angeles, or coastal flooding, or, you know, tornadoes, or whatever it is. But this kind of, we see countless narratives produced by Hollywood where there's the destruction of a kind of American city, but then there's always the hero who perseveres.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for me personally, in having lived through the past 15 years in this country, right, like probably most of us have, the destruction is starting to look more like what you see on the TV news.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to have doubts or curiosity about that hero. Are we actually going to make it through this? How are we going to make it through this? So I think those narratives resonate in very powerful ways. I think the Hollywood model of the lone hero, Brad Pitt or whoever, Tom Cruise, that perseveres through this destruction and kind of somehow stops it or survives, I think we need to see narratives that offer a little more than that. I think there's space and the need in our collective imagination to see something else.
And why all the, what's her fascination with zombies, do you think, currently?
Well, you know, I have my own personal read, which is that, you know, zombies represent the, you know, the kind of the fears that we have about us of all the people that we depend on, all the people that we need to sustain our livelihoods that we don't see. And so, you know, Karl Marx actually uses the phrase zombies and monsters often to talk about capitalism and to talk about the ways in which capitalism transforms human relationships. He uses the phrase monsters and zombies a lot. There's a book I just ordered called Monsters of the Market, all about Marx's use of the figure of zombies and monsters in his texts. And so anyway, I personally believe in the zombie as a kind of cipher or a stand-in for the all the kind of ghosts that surround us, whether it's people that, like I mentioned, pick our food, make our clothing, that the people that surround mm-hmm. us and give us sustenance, but that are also invisible, and the fears that invisible population also creates, you know, that kind of specter is how I personally read the zombie. But it's such a fantastic figure, you know, the undead. It's,
well, you gave me a lot more to think about the next time I see the next zombie film or the next episode of Walking Dead. Alex, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Yeah. Alex Rivera is an award-winning filmmaker, director of Sleep Dealer, which is a futuristic science fiction film about immigration. He also directed a new music video for the National Day Laborers Organizing Network featuring Allo Black singing the chart-topping hit Wake Me Up. Alex is in Wisconsin this fall as artist-in-residence at the UW-Madison, and he will be tonight in Madison on the opening panel for Tales from Planet Earth, the film festival. And by the way, Alex, if people want to see Sleep Dealer, how can they see it? It's, I think, not on Netflix right at the moment.
Right now, the film is kind of a zombie. It's in between distributors. We'll be relaunching the film this January through Sundance Digital, and so it'll be in all the kind of spaces in January. But right now, you can get copies of it on Amazon or on Pirate Bay.
Oh, you didn't say that. Okay, Alex Rivera, thank you very much. And when we come back, we will be previewing a film by 3 14-year-old Bad River Ojibwe youth about the effect of a proposed open-pit taconite mine on the Bad River watershed's people. I'm Ann Strange Jampson. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 10 tonight, it's Snap Judgment. This week, Unrequited, real stories of affection, desire, and longing, spurned, burned, and unreturned. I'm Ann Strange Champs, and I mentioned earlier the Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival runs through the weekend in Madison, and among the films being screened is a short documentary made, remarkably, by 3 14-year-olds from the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe. It's called Protect Our Future. And advising the young filmmakers was a figure familiar to Wisconsin Public Television audiences, is Patty Lowe. She's a filmmaker herself, an author, and UW-Madison professor, and also an enrolled member of the Bad River Band. And Patty, welcome.
And thank you.
Yeah. So I want to start by getting a quick sense of the film. So let's play a short clip from the very beginning of Protect Our Future.
This is the Bad River Indian Reservation. There are about 1,100 tribal members who live on the reservation. Many of them live here in Odena, a community that will be impacted by the mine. But there are other non-Indian communities that lie in the path of the mine.
My children are the seventh generation from Chief Blackbird, who created this place in the 1854 treaty on Madeline Island. And he was, of course, thinking of the seventh generation when he saved this place. Wild rice is what we've always lived on. The Ojibwe people up in this area. That's why we settled here. We came here on a mission long ago, hundreds, probably thousands of years.
That's just a bit from the beginning of the film. Patty, tell us about it. How did it come about?
Well, I've been working in Native communities with middle schoolers since 2007 on something called the Tribal Youth Media Project. Mm-hmm. And we, me and graduate students go into a community, we meet with elders, and we ask them what sorts of ecological or scientific knowledge do they want their kids to learn. And then the elders identify resources in that community. And we also use scientists from Great Lakes in Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we integrate traditional ecological knowledge into science, Western science, and teach these young people media skills, teach them how to operate high-definition cameras and edit and compose music. The music you heard in that piece was composed by a 14-year-old boy, by the way.
Wow.
He's now 15. But
wow.
So we ask them to tell a story. And in the process of telling that story, when you have to figure out what visuals to use in order to make your case for whatever kind of information you're presenting, it reinforces your own learning.
Mm-hmm.
And it also builds a lot of confidence. Storytelling in our communities is a pretty valued tradition.
Well, and you're taking it into the future. I mean, really what you're doing is raising up the next generation of storytellers.
We are.
In your community, but giving them digital media skills. So
right,
that they're,
right.
You know, bridging these two cultures.
So we're trying to grow the next generation of land stewards and digital storytellers. And last year, or 2 years ago, we've worked in a couple of different Native communities, most recently Bad River. And we worked with 10 students initially, and there were three students who really rose to the top of that mm-hmm. class. And so I received a small grant from the First Peoples Fund of Rapid City, South Dakota, which allowed me to buy a high-definition camera and for Bad River, leave it in the community, mm-hmm. and hire three students to work on this feature-length documentary.
Yeah. And so now what's the story that they're telling? It's about this planned open-pit taconite mine. Is the mine definitely happening?
No, it's a proposed mine mm-hmm. at this point. But the story is really about environmental stewardship and about Bad River's ancient wild rice beds and how culturally, environmentally, and spiritually important that resource is to the people of Bad River. Then, of course, the students wanted to understand what this threat was from this proposed mine mm-hmm. and understand it, and also try to figure out how the community felt about it.
Mm-hmm. And those wild rice beds, wild rice for the Bad River is not just a food source or a crop. It goes back into identity and creation stories, doesn't it?
And it really does. I mean, that's one of our oldest stories, is the migration of the Ojibwe people from the East Coast. We initially believe we were here in the Upper Great Lakes. There's a flood. We go east. There's a crisis. Through prophecy, we come to understand we need to go back to our original homes where the food grows on water.
That's the prophecy.
And so
find the food that grows on water.
And that food, of course, is Manoman or wild rice. And so wild rice is the covenant that we as Ojibwe people have with our creator, and it's part of all of our ceremonies. It's been our staple food source for generations. It's high in protein. It's very nutritious. It supports a whole diverse ecosystem of water and plants and small mammals and waterfowl and larger mammals and human beings. So it really is the center of our universe. Mm.
And some of the loveliest moments in the film are when you hear the young filmmakers talking with some of the elders who are explaining. And I don't know if they've heard these stories before, but it's wonderful as an audience member to hear them. So we're lucky enough to have a couple of the young filmmakers on the phone with us, taking a break from their classes at Ashland High School, Jordan Principato and Shania Jackson. And Patty, I'm going to let you introduce them and bring them in for us.
Okay. Jordan and Shania, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning to you both. Jordan Principato was the videographer on this project. And let me tell you something about this young man. He shot nearly every frame of video in this documentary. There's one shot that I supplied of a blue heron who happened to take flight when Jordan had already packed up his camera gear and I still had a camera on my lap. Jordan, you know, at 14, understands the rule of thirds and perspectives. And wow. At one point, I have to share the story with you because, and Jordan, maybe you remember this. We wanted to get some shots of the community, and Jordan suggested that we drive in the van with the side door open, and he'd point the camera out and have the camera on his lap to steady it, and I would drive slowly through the community, and he would have a rolling shot of the central area of Odena.
It was brilliant.
Jordan, that was a great suggestion, and the video looks, you know, that particular section of video looks great in the documentary. But there were...
Isn't that the clip that was played?
Yeah, actually it was. It was.
And Jordan, what's your favorite scene in the film? Do you have one?
The one of me, you know, filming. It's the one of me filming everybody walking up the mine.
Yeah, let's talk about that mine walk, because there were some pretty tough moments, physical moments in this. Jordan had to shoot around sandflies at Waverly Beach, and there was, you know, we had rain and wind and...
Welcome to the life of a filmmaker.
Right. But at one point, the Pinocchio Hills Education Project scheduled an informational walk to the mine site, and they said it was 3 miles, but boy, didn't it seem longer than that, Jordan?
It was about 2.5 miles up and down.
Right. Why don't you describe what that walk was like?
It was a long, hard walk up, mostly uphill. And all you saw was the beautiful trees, birds, and we saw a beaver. Well, I did.
And were you lugging all your camera equipment, too?
Yeah.
Wow. So that must have made it even harder.
At one point, I had to ask my brother's fiancée to carry it for me.
Now, were you stopping to shoot all along the way, too?
Yeah.
So, and are there any things that you shot?
At the back of the pack.
Okay. So is there anything that you shot on that walk that we see in the film?
Yeah, almost everything.
And once you got up to the mine site, what did it look like and what did it sound like?
It sounded like a bunch of drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't sound very good.
Yeah.
It just sounded like they were just taking samples.
So what were you thinking about when you were there, you know, filming? Were you thinking about, I want to make sure I get this shot, or were you thinking, wow, this is not what I thought it would be like?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that it would be like that.
What did you think it would be like?
I just thought it would be, you know, just them. And then just the guys up there mining with a few cops. It wasn't just a few cops.
What was it?
There were like three different counties there.
Of police, yeah. police and sheriffs and DNR folks.
There was like 18 cops there at least, Patty?
Yeah, I think you're right. There were at least a dozen and a half or so.
So it was a much bigger operation than you'd expected.
Yeah.
Oh. What are you proudest of about the film?
I'm proud of the fact that I just got the opportunity to do this.
Well, congratulations. I hope it is just your first film, and I hope there are many more in your future.
He really does have a gift.
Thanks.
And then we also have Shania with us. And Shania was the person who not only wrote the script and does the narration. You heard her voice. And that was her father that she was interviewing, who is the education. Dana Jackson is the education director for Bad River. But Shania, this was the first time she ever did any on-camera presentations. So you see her, and, you know, for a young woman to put herself out there really says something about her. And she just did a marvelous job. And Shania, you know, one of my favorite parts in the documentary is at the end when you talk about what you learned from working on the documentary and what concerns you have. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I learned that Wild Rice goes back to the people 7 generations before us and even before that. And it's good that it's still around.
Yeah.
Here.
You learned geology too. I remember there are those moments when you're actually learning about the rocks. Did that, I don't know, change how you feel about the land that you live on?
Kind of.
Yeah, that was really a great suggestion that came from the kids. They wanted to include some science teachers and Tom Fitz, who's a professor at Northland College, is one of the people that was recommended to the group to interview. But, you know, Shania, what did you learn about culture? Because your family, Rices. There are pictures, the young woman that you see.
Oh, that's right. There are pictures of you in a canoe, right? Gathering rice?
Yeah.
Right.
And who's that with you in the canoe?
My brother.
Oh. Yeah, so it's a family thing for the Jackson family. And in the film, you talk about, you know, what concerns you have. And I thought that was a really important moment. You want to talk about that a little bit more? About what fears you have?
My fears that I have is that the wild rice won't be around if the mine goes through. And
yeah,
it's important to us because we use it in ceremonies and gatherings.
Right.
Well, Shania, thank you so much and Jordan, thank you both so much for joining us. And Patty, I wanted to, before we go, just hear a clip from the film. There's a section where the, I think it's the elders who are talking a bit. Let's hear that bit.
I don't approve of any degradation to our mother, the earth. And Nimama Kinan takes care of us. And we know from the beginning of time that as long as we took care of her, she would take care of us. Today, society is changing so much that they're forgetting where everything comes from and not seeing that in the destroying the earth so significantly, we are destroying the people.
Patty, what did it mean to you personally to produce this film?
Well, I helped produce it, but these kids really did the work. For me, as a tribal member, I know these stories, and I personally am very invested in this whole mining issue. And so to be able to work with young people who already knew a little bit about this. Shania had written a paper about this for a class in middle school. But to work with these young people and see them, through their conversations with elders, gain the knowledge and feel committed and feel protective of this rice, and this resource was just so gratifying. It really was. And I just want to send out some props to Apane Thomas, who composed that beautiful music that you listened to.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Patty, and sharing the film with us. Patty Lowe is a filmmaker, a longtime Wisconsin Public Television host, author, and UW-Madison professor, and member of the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe. We also talked with two of the filmmakers. That was Jordan Principato and Shania Jackson. They're both freshmen at Ashland High School. Tales for Planet Earth Film Festival goes through the weekend in Madison. It's all free. For more information, check our Facebook page, 45 North, on WPR. Today's show was produced by Marika Suval, and today we also bid a fond farewell to producer Rhonda Fanning. She's deserting us for balmy Austin, Texas, and a new job at member station KUT. Rhonda, we'll miss you, your excellent taste in guests and music. Thank you for all the great hours of radio you've given us. We had technical direction today from Dave Potrez. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk a bit again next week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.